The following lecture was delivered at the 15th Annual National Jewish Retreat in Atlanta, Georgia, a project of the Rohr Jewish Learning Institute. We hope you enjoy it, and we encourage you to visit jretreat.com for information on upcoming retreats. Mrs. Chaya Rachel Estrin and Rabbi Eli Estrin will now present their fascinating journey of medicine, miracles, and mindsets.
Good evening, good evening. Thanks so much for, of course, coming here. It's wonderful, wonderful to be at the National Jewish Retreat. So everybody's got a story. Everybody has a journey. Some are slightly more epic than others. And I think from our past few years, my wife and I have learned that epic is overrated. You go through things that are sometimes a little bit more stressful, some things that are a little bit less stressful. But it's really all about what you learn from the experiences. That's the whole point. There's a beautiful verse that says, "B'machashakim hoshivani," which means that in the darkness you returned me. And one of the meanings behind that verse is that we can learn so much as a result of darkness. We can learn so much about ourselves and you know, even more on a much deeper level, we can learn so much about God as a result of some of the stressful things that we go through. So my wife and I, thank God, we have a journey that we've been sharing over the past few years. And that journey, we've titled it Of Medicine, Miracles, and Mindsets because it really is the story of our youngest son who has complex congenital heart disease. And to really get a sense of why we called this talk of medicine, miracles, and mindsets. Of course, medicine, well, complex congenital heart disease, so medicine is obviously an integral part of it. Miracles, we'll tell you all about those very soon. But the mindsets are a critical element of that. And to talk about the mindsets just a moment, I want to take a step back. I'll be talking tomorrow a little bit about my Air Force experience. And the previous chief of staff of the Air Force was General David Goldfein. And I saw a video in which he was talking about the first time he flew an F-16 into combat. And he thought to himself, as he's taking off on the runway, he thought to himself, you know, what's it going to be like when they're actually shooting at me? They're trying to kill me. They're trying to knock me out of the sky. And as soon as he got into that space, and this was over Bosnia, he realized this is no different than my training. And all I have to do is apply my training, and I'll be okay. And the same is true with every single one of us. We have ideas, we have messages that we've learned from basic Judaism, or sometimes from Hasidic philosophy, or from philosophy of any type within Judaism. And those are mindsets that are sitting within our heads. And sometimes we find ourselves in crisis, and we need to apply those mindsets. And so it's very, very important, not just for us to tell this story, but also to point out the mindsets that brought us through this journey, because that's really how we got through the entire experience. So that's really what it was all about. And for that, I'm going to turn the mic over to my wife, Chaya Rachel. She's going to introduce our little story and how we found out about our youngest son.
Good evening.
You're on here.
So it started off, this was our sixth child, and I went for a prenatal ultrasound, and I was followed up by telling me that I had to go for a full workup because they found problems with the heart. So a week later, I found myself with my husband in a four-hour ultrasound and different types of imaging and scanning, and we sat down in a room afterwards, and they explained to us that our unborn child has 3 of the 12 severe cardiac defects. He has unbalanced AV canal, or a single ventricle, so half a heart, pulmonary atresia, and TAPVC, which is total anomalous pulmonary venous connection.
So just a moment, this over here, this is a regular heart, and then we flip to the next one. This is what his heart looked like when he was born.
So we were not cardiologists. We had basic high school biology, maybe a little bit more. We were completely confused. So I'll tell you what we understood from that conversation, and we can move on. Basically, obviously the heart and lungs work together. The heart pumps the blood to the body. First it pumps the blood to the lungs. The lungs give the blood fresh oxygen. Then it goes back to the heart. The heart then pumps the blood to the body, and then the cycle continues. So basically, our child had three different defects that messed up with that system. So his heart-lung connection was not very functional. They did tell us in that room that there were surgical options for these heart defects. Very, very few kids have this combination of heart defects, but there are surgical options. But then on top of that, they told us that they didn't see his stomach in the ultrasound. His esophagus looks large, so there was this undiagnosed GI issue. And so the conclusion of our meeting, that was probably 6 hours, was that there is really no hope for this child because he has severe, severe cardiac defects plus very complicated GI stuff. And you can't have so many things wrong at the same time and try to surgically fix it. So that was sort of where we were left reeling. We had 10 weeks left of this pregnancy, and we had to figure out what we were going to do, how we were going to deal with all of this, what we were going to do with our other 5 children, and turn it over to you.
So actually, the night that we found out about this disaster, I guess if you want to call it at that point, was Hanukkah. And that night, we were speaking for our college students. At that point, we were directing Chabad University of Washington. And we had our regular, like in every campus, every city, I'm sure every one of you have been to them, the menorah lightings. This is our biggest event of the year. And I've just been hit by this information, and I've just been told by the nurse who has not, at that point, had not even given us the full diagnosis, but told us that there's really no way for this child to survive. So I'm already reeling from this, and what was that? This is 10 weeks before the baby was born. This is 30 weeks, or 9 weeks, actually, I think it was. So you're standing in there in front of the menorah. You're the rabbi. You're there. So you're supposed to be the inspiration to everybody else. But here's a little secret. Sometimes we rabbis don't speak to the crowd. We speak to ourselves. And that's exactly what happened there. I kind of reached into myself and I said, okay, what's the message of the menorah? The message of the menorah is that miracles do happen and that God can do miracles whenever he wants. And that's, in fact, that's the blessing that we say on the menorah, she'asanisim lavoteinu bayim imahem bazman hazeh, that God did miracles in those days and does miracles nowadays. So that was the very first mindset that we knew that we needed. It was an idea that every single one of you are aware of, but it was something that we knew we needed to apply to our circumstance. Now, we knew that God doesn't just drop miracles wherever we are. There are unique times that God grants miracles, and I can't pretend to tell you why we got the miracles that we did. But we knew that we need to focus on this. And this is one of the next elements of getting through the next few weeks was the recognition of these ideas, these mindsets, and trying to integrate them into ourselves to be able to keep ourselves stable. And that was really, really that was crucial for the entire experience. So the very first mindset that really we just spoke about is miracles. And what is a miracle? The fact of the matter is that every single one of us here is a miracle. But we don't oftentimes recognize that because we're just living the here and now. But when we think about our history, where we've come from, where our grandparents came from, and even further back, there are untold miracles that we don't even know anything about, let alone every single moment, everything that's going on within ourselves. So there are miracles that happen within nature, and then there's sometimes when God decides to just completely upend nature and destroy it. And so that was number one, the recognition that God is working the system, God is in full control. If he wants, he can give us a miracle. That was mindset number one. Mindset number two, it comes from a Talmudic statement, which was very, very powerful. And that is, even if an unsheathed sword is on a person's neck, a person should never withhold themselves from mercy. There's a Jewish pop song with these words. You know, sometimes they put music to lyrics that are not quite, they don't quite fit the message. But because of that pop song, I knew this quote. And these words reverberated through my head. And every single week from this point on, we went to OB visits. And at the OB visits, there was a Jewish social worker there who would ask us, so have you planned out the baby's last moments? Have you made plans for a funeral? Have you contacted the Chevra Kadisha, the Jewish Burial Society? And we kept on trying to explain to them that's not the Jewish approach. The Jewish approach to life is to live life, to embrace life, every moment of life. And even if we're in a desperate situation, I'm not withholding myself from mercy. In other words, as soon as I give up, that's the point when I'm withholding myself from mercy. When the Talmud's using a very, very specific term. When I give up, the game's over. But as long as I don't give up, we have a fighting chance. And when it's over, we'll accept it when it's over. But it's not over yet. We have just begun to fight. I don't know who's, what do you call it? I think he lost that battle, by the way. But that's a different story. So that was the second very, very, very important mindset. And the third one here is an interesting one. Think good and it will be good. And this one actually, I want to point out that this was actually something that stuck in our craw very, very much throughout these 9 weeks. It was a struggle. Because it's very difficult to absorb think good and it'll be good when somebody's telling you to plan for a funeral. Knowing the theological element behind this idea was what allowed us, both of us, to discuss it and decide how we were going to deal with it. And the theological element is that by thinking good, you create an avenue for goodness. It creates a new pathway that might not have been there before. And so that's an important, important point, because it's not just this kind of cutesy, oh, well, it's all good, Hakuna Matata. I think that's Yiddish. I don't remember. So that was a very, very, very important element of it, that we were going to think good. So we discussed this. We had conversations sitting on the couch just like this, basically. How do we apply this idea? And we decided that the way we were going to apply the idea was simply by recognizing that God can make this birth go right. And so therefore, even though we know the situation is very desperate, we're going to try to line things up in such a way that if God decides to do a miracle, we'll be there to be able to receive it. If God doesn't do a miracle, well, we'll deal with that as well. So with that, Chaya, back to you.
Okay, so practically, what did we do over these 9 weeks until he was going to be born? So firstly, we had to take a two-tier approach. We did, the physical preparation and then the spiritual preparation, and we kind of bounced back and forth between the two. So on a practical level, we got a second opinion, which is one of the things that the Lubavitcher Rebbe always says, is always get a second opinion. So we sent our scans to Boston Children's Hospital, who, unfortunately, we waited desperately for them to say everything will work out, but they didn't. They agreed with our team in Seattle that said the combination of defects that we see, there's no hope. So, okay, we're devastated, but we're going to try to keep moving. We redid all the scans a month later, waiting for our miracle, and it was the same outcome. And then on a spiritual level, we prayed. My husband went to the Rebbe's gravesite to pray. We got all our mezuzos on our doors checked, which is one of the things that's very often connected with healing and I don't want to say good luck because it's not the way it is, but a change of mazel. And we actually, interestingly enough, one of the mezuzahs that we had in our basement, which we didn't need to have there because we were renting it out to people who weren't Jewish, two words were wrong, missing,
cracked,
levavchem and bincham, which means your son and your heart. So we were like, okay, we're going to fix it, and it's all going to be good. But that happened before we took the second scans, and it was still the same story. So, okay, we don't understand this. And we spent a lot of time really, talking with each other, trying to strategize how to help our kids, how to help each other, what was going to be like our, how are we going to support each other through this? And like he said, Every visit, and as you get closer to delivery, your visits increase, and as you're high risk, they increase. They would ask us, did you plan for your funeral? Do you know what your last moments? What type of room do you want the room, do you want it to be? And so every week, it was this reeling back and trying to build ourselves up to get pushed down again. We tried to keep it a secret. I don't know what people like to keep medical things quiet, because we learned it was really, really hard, and we shared it with our friends and family, who really, really rallied and came together and gave us so much love and support. They came to visit us, just anything that they could to help us. But it was really, really tough. The other thing that we did is we spoke to some friends who, unfortunately, their baby had hydrocephalus, so there was which means the brain never really developed. And they chose to carry the baby full term. And so we spoke to them about, what did they do? What was the end like? What did you do with your kids? How did you recover after it? So one of the things they told us is they chose a name for the baby. There's different traditions. Some people choose not to choose a name for a baby that's not going to survive, but they let the Chevra Kedisha, the Jewish burial service, choose the name. But this mother decided she wanted to choose a name for the baby herself, and she lights a Shabbat candle for the baby even now, even though the baby really... According to Jewish law, if a baby doesn't live 30 days, it's not really the same status with, in terms of mourning and burial that you do with a baby that basically is stillbirth, or a baby that lives a few hours. So I was sitting on the couch and I was thinking about that she chose a name, and I was thinking about, what name would I want to choose for this child that we know is not going to survive? We don't know if the baby's going to survive birth. And the name that came to me, we didn't know at that time whether it was going to be a boy or a girl, but the name that came to me, we thought it was going to be a girl because we had two boys right on top. So we needed to have a girl to balance things out. So it was Netanya, which means God gives, Natan and then Hashem's name. And I thought, I don't feel like this is from God, but I want to remember that this is from God, even when it feels hurtful and painful. And so that was the name we chose, was either Netanya or Netanel. Or Nisanel, which is that God gives, because I wanted a reminder, in my face, that this is from God, so that hopefully I will be able to believe that, because I believed it. Hopefully I'd be able to feel it, and really it would help soothe the pain that we were feeling. And the last thing we did, we also spoke to social workers, Chai Lifeline, which some of you may have heard of, how to talk to our kids, how to deal with all the trauma. So we kind of got all our pieces in place. We found a doctor who was a friend, that can really advocate for us, because we learned through this whole process that you always need to have someone who's going to advocate for you. Because, like I said, our biology level was very, very low at that point, and we didn't know what they're talking about. So you need to have someone who's really going to advocate for you. So we found a doctor who had actually, our oldest son was a preemie, and he had been a doctor on the team then, and he had been, very helpful and kind. And so we asked him if he can sit down and listen to the case. Maybe he has some magic, new ideas that nobody's heard of, and maybe he'll be able to help us. So he agreed to sit down with us and sort of help us through it.
So I sat down with this doctor. I explained to him what's going on, and he said basically there's no chance for this baby to be able to live. I said, I understand that, but we're trying to look for an advocate, somebody to be able to help out. He was a neonatologist, and so that was the reason why we figured he'd have a general picture and he would be able to reach into the different systems to be able to give us some new avenues. And we then had a conversation about quality of life. He said, well, even if this baby survives, there's no way he'll have any quality of life whatsoever. I said, wait a second. Quality of life is completely subjective. I work on Collins Avenue, and not a day goes by when I don't see a car that's worth $300,000. And sometimes these cars come in the wrong shade of pink, and the owner is devastated. They can't live because their Lamborghini came in the wrong shade of pink. There are things like that. It's all subjective. And so what's quality of life? For us, it's life itself. For Jews, it's all about life. It's about body and soul. So it seemed like he understood that. So I said, can you look at the scans and get involved with the case? He said, you give me permission. I said, sure, absolutely. We're looking for an advocate. He said, sure, no problem. He looked at the scans and he said, listen, there's no way this baby's going to be able to survive. I need you to come up with a, plan for end of life. We're like, okay, not another one of these guys. But I didn't have the understanding to tell him, okay, enough, I don't want you. And that was a mistake. But eventually I sat down with a rabbi and we had a discussion, you know, about what things would need to look like. And the rabbi asked him, hey, is there any way that this baby, maybe your scans are wrong, maybe there's some information that you don't have? He goes, there's a 99% chance that our scans are right, and I'm only giving you the 1% because I have to. You know, the baby basically can't breathe because he's got no pulmonary heart connection. And even if he does survive birth, that'll be a shock. And if he survives the testing that we do after birth, that would be more of a surprise. And then he'd have to survive the ambulance drive from the University of Washington Medical Center. In the book, it's not meant called that, by the way. till you get to Children's Hospital. And after surviving that, there's no way that he would survive surgery itself. And if he happened to survive surgery, he'd be a vegetable. So the rabbi said, in that case, there's nothing, you're saying that medically speaking, there's nothing to do. He said, that's correct. I said, okay, even with that said, what I want you to do is to prepare as if the baby can survive and we'll go from there. He said, oh, that's no problem, we can do that. Because there's a small hole between the heart and lungs called the ductus arteriosus. And we can give him a medicine called prostaglandin to keep the ductus arteriosus open for an extra hour or two. And then we can do some of the scans. If he happens to survive birth, we'll see if there's anything else there. Great. That's the plan. So we set up that Chaya would be induced. And these 9 weeks passed very, very, very slowly. And finally, on 9 weeks, yeah, nine weeks. So, yeah, it was two months, and over 2 months. From when we found out. That's correct. Monday morning, or technically speaking, actually afternoon, 12:47, I think it was, that Nissi was born. And as you see him over here, Chaya asked me to take a picture because we didn't know if we'd want a picture or not, you know, not expecting to survive at all, but she said, take a picture in case I want it for later. So there you see, he's a little bit purple, and that's because single ventricle kids are typically slightly purple. And they whipped him over to the other side. They, they quickly did an ultrasound, or it might have been an X-ray. I don't remember exactly what they did with him. And then an hour later, when they gave him the prostaglandin, actually, immediately, and then they put nasal prongs on him. And then about an hour later, they brought the baby back to me, and this doctor, we'll call him Dr. Ralph, handed me the baby and said, "This baby's not going to survive to see sunset tonight." And pulled the nasal prongs off of him. Now, the rabbis had told us there are actually two things you're not allowed to do. If the baby was intubated, we would not be allowed to take the oxygen out, off. But he was not intubated. There was just nasal flow. It was just oxygen flow. But there was another line that went through my head, which is going to be on one of the other slides over here in a few minutes. Doctors have permission to heal, and that's a Talmudic statement. And the third Rebbe of Chabad said, but not to predict, not to cause depression by predicting. And that line went through my head, and I thought to myself, as I'm holding this purple kid, looks cute, but he's purple. And I said to him, in my head, I said, come on, kid, make it past sunset, just to tell this doctor he's not God. And I was like, if we can get the 4 hours to sunset, you know, that'll be already something. And what do? You're holding the baby, you're holding the baby, you're holding the baby. You're singing to him, you're trying to pray as much as you can. It was actually Rosh Chodesh that night, and I guess we'll get to that in just a moment. But we were hoping to get into Rosh Chodesh because a new month has new energy, and especially the month of Adar. Adar, one of the meanings of the word, stands for Ani Hashem Rofecha, which means I am God who heals you. So we're hoping to be able to get that energy, something. You know, basically you're holding whatever elements of hope, grip tape you're possibly, you know, that's what you're just going for. But in the meantime, sunset came and went, and he wasn't dead. And so we called the nurse over. We said, hey, can we maybe get a cardiologist in here to be able to look at him? Because obviously what they said was going to happen doesn't happen. He looks like he's doing fine. He's just sitting here munching on a pacifier as if he's got not a care in the world. And the nurse kind of hemmed and hawed, and then eventually she brought in a charge nurse from the NICU. Now, the charge nurse basically gave us a real attitude. She goes, well, if you want to go to the hospital, children's hospital, you need to go right now, but I don't know why you want to go there. I said, well, if we make a plan, you know, it would be good to be able to see another cardiologist. She said, well, there's nothing really else to do, but if you want to go, you need to go now. I said, well, what's the plan? She said, well, there is no plan. I said, so then why would we go to Children's Hospital? She said, well, that's your choice. I said, what's my choice? And there's this kind of circular conversation, and it just went absolutely nowhere. And we said, okay, we went back to holding the baby. At 2 o'clock in the morning, the baby's still alive, and at some point he pooped, and we said, oh, that must mean he has a stomach. And the nurse said, nah, it just means that he has functioning guts. But actually, I was right, she was wrong. Don't want to dig it in or anything like that, but that was... The next morning dawns, and I can't tell you what it was like to fall asleep, because you just simply didn't know what you were going to wake up holding the next morning, so it was quite intense. The baby's still alive. And we said, okay, well, now we need to get some feeds on this baby, whether there's a stomach here or not. We've got to get him on IV. And the nurse said, well, there's a 24-hour fat reserve, so you don't need anything till, you know, for 24 hours. I said, well, at 12 o'clock, we're putting an IV in. She said, well, at 12 o'clock, Dr. Ralph is coming back. I said, I don't want to see him. My wife is trying to calm me down. My mother-in-law is trying to, you know. Was I going crazy? No, we were trying to sound rational. That was part of the idea here. But it felt like we were talking like crazy people, because the medical personnel was just simply not taking us seriously. And I kept on telling them, look at him clinically. I'm not asking you to look from the perspective of a grieving father. Clinically, he's breathing, he's sleeping, he's breathing. Like, we're good, right? Why are we not getting him into surgery? We did not know that Dr. Ralph called Children's Hospital and told them that we refused invasive care. And from that point on, we were already being pushed into hospice care. And that was actually when Dr. Ralph came back, you know, he was still trying to push that. And he said, listen, we looked at the scans yesterday. He says, first of all, I need to apologize. Sometimes these things take a little bit longer. I said, yeah, sometimes they take 70 or 80 years. He ignored me. And he said, listen, we actually looked at the scans again, and we saw that it seems like he has something. I told you, this heart disease oftentimes comes with more stuff. And, you know, he has a syndrome called heterotaxy. Heterotaxy is one in 250,000 live births. The internal organs are either upside down, flipped, backwards, or any combination of that. There was a doctor who told us that you throw 200 internal defects into a hat and let the family pick 20, and that's heterotaxy. So he said, based on that, the kid might have a stomach, and if he has a stomach, if he wants, you can try to feed him, which I think was the dumbest line you could possibly tell a Jewish mother. No kidding, get the heck out of here, and we filled up 5 milliliters of sugar water, put it in his mouth, and he gave us a look like, it's about time you tried to feed me. What kind of parents are you? And we fed him 10 milliliters. He's eating that. He's not aspirating. He's not choking. He's not having any problems. We go up to formula. He's eating that. He's eating. He's peeping. He's pooping. He's doing all the things babies should do. Why are we not getting him into surgery? And in the meantime, he basically looked like that on a regular day, which basically looked like a perfectly fine baby to us. Maybe we're biased, but you know, we thought he was cute. This went on for 4 days. And on the third day, on Wednesday actually, Chaya's old OB came upstairs and she said, Chai Rachel, she said, you need to go out and exercise because you've been sitting in this bed since Sunday night. And so Chai Rachel's usually very, very anxious with the babies. She tells me, listen, I've held the baby for 9 months. You take him. It's your turn. But this one she was very, very, very protective of, and she was holding him most of the time, and I was just giving her a chance to stretch or whatever it was. And she said, can I hold the baby? She said, well, you won't be able to leave the ward because of the alarm. And Chai Rachel says, he doesn't have an alarm on him. And the OB looks down, sees there's no alarm, and without another word marches out. And 5 minutes later, the nurse comes back in, and she says, well, he actually wasn't admitted as a patient until now. So this is day 3 of his life. He was born Monday, this is Tuesday, Wednesday. They wanted us out of the labor and delivery room badly, so they eventually sent us into the NICU. Not because they were going to be doing anything, but because they wanted us out of labor and delivery room, and we weren't going home to have the baby die in front of his siblings. Circle of life. We're pulling Lion King tonight. I don't know why. just like didn't seem the kind of thing that we were particularly interested in sharing with our kids. But to make a long story short, Thursday morning came, and the baby was still alive. We decided we need to leave the hospital. They said you need to leave in hospice care. We said we don't want to. They said you have to, otherwise there's going to be a police investigation. We said okay, fine. They said okay, here's morphine for his last moments. We said, sorry, we don't do drugs. We don't do heavy drugs for a kid who doesn't seem to need them. And we have other kids at home. Didn't want that. Then they handed us a do not resuscitate form. We said, no, we're not doing that. That was another little argument. And just as we're going, I asked for a car seat to take him home. They said, oh, you don't need one. And so they sent us home without a car seat. Obviously, we didn't bring a car seat with it because he was either going to go into surgery or not. So those were our first several days. So during those days, Chaya is going to talk a little bit about the perspectives of going through ahead during those days.
Well, we tried. So on a practical level, you know, we were advised that, you know, it will be too traumatic for our kids to really experience this, you know, meet him and then have him taken so quickly. So the initial plan was not to have them meet him, but by Wednesday, our plan was out the window. So they came to visit him for a few minutes. My husband had the wonderful job of going home and breaking the news to our two older kids that, you know, the baby was really sick, and then he stopped at kid three because he couldn't. But really, you know, during those moments, I don't even know if we were heartbroken. We were just in this, like, what's the word?
A daze?
Yeah, like a twilight zone, that was what. But we really, you know those moments like Ellie was talking about earlier about, like, that you're inundated with messages and sometimes you have to tap into them. This was definitely one of those moments where we were trying to consciously remind ourselves of two really important, you know, things that we grew up with and we never really had to apply them to this level. And the first one is that every moment of life has infinite value. And Judaism teaches us that every moment that a body and soul are united is fulfilling a purpose. And if it wasn't, it wouldn't happen. God wants this person to be in this earth, and it's fulfilling a purpose. And even if we don't understand the purpose, and we don't see that this person is serving purpose, we know that he or she is, otherwise they wouldn't be here. And so we really tried to hold on to that message and remind ourselves that every moment that this child is here, clearly his soul is in his body, there's a purpose for this. And we are being the conduits for this soul to be here, and we're going to try to do the best we can for this obviously special soul that its purpose is only hours or days and not seeming to be what we all think life's purpose is. So we really tried to think about that and remind ourselves that and look for moments that we could sort of like, this is why he's here. So, you know, we tried, like I said, we shared with people. So we asked people to pray for him. People took on mitzvot in his honor. And we actually found out later that people koshered their home or started keeping Shabbat in honor of our little boy that they had never met, lived across the world. But people, like, it was unbelievable. We were running a Chabad on campus at the time, and the Chabad on campus community is a pretty close-knit community. And a lot of the other shluchim, I would say all of them, you know, put out to their students and asked them to put on tefillin or light Shabbat candles. And we got hundreds of pictures of selfies of kids putting on tefillin in honor of our little baby. And that was sort of trying to remind ourselves, like, we don't know the purpose, but this child is clearly being a catalyst for good in this world. And so that was really sort of what we held on to. It wasn't easy. There were definitely hard moments of it, but we tried to sort of, you know, as much as we could. At one point, one of the nurses was Jewish, and she was a sister of one of the students that had become religious in our Chabad house. So we, you know, tried to talk to her. We're like, maybe this is the reason. So we're really just trying to recognize and internalize this message that a soul and a body together is serving a purpose. And our purpose, what we define as purpose, is not necessarily a purpose. And really trying to remind ourselves and live with that throughout that time kind of gave us a little bit of like hope and like a bandage and like, this is not just that we have bad luck, but we're fulfilling something bigger than ourselves. So anyway, hospice care, we go home with a baby and we don't know what to do. Go ahead.
You know, you take a regular baby home and everything's pretty standard. On the other hand, this was not standard at all. We hadn't really slept in several days, actually. You know, there were, I don't know if you can even call them catnaps. But one of the things that happened right before we left the hospital was one of the strangest little things. There's an organization called And Now I Lay Me Down to Sleep. And this organization is a volunteer photographers that come and take pictures of babies that don't make it. We had been offered this organization's assistance, if you want to call it that, or service, several times before the baby was born. And we kept on saying that, no, that's not the Jewish approach. No, that's incredibly macabre. That's not my kind of deal at all. But just as I was fighting with the nurse about one of the DNR or something else, you know, the social worker came, and while handing Chaya a card, which was a pretty flowery card, it said, thinking of you, and on the inside, she said, here's a pretty card. Inside has the phone number of the Chevra Kadisha. Maybe it'll be easier for your husband to handle with a prettier card. It's what we call the definition of absurd. And the other thing she said is, do you want this organization to come? So Chayrachel's like, look, you want to send a photographer, send a photographer. I don't care. You know, be my guest. Do whatever you want. Now, if I would have heard that, I, you know, my hair would have been going, you know, like, are you crazy? Or whatever it is. But I didn't hear that. We get home, and I drove home very, very slowly. Chayrachel was holding the baby in the back seat. And we get home. First thing is, of course, davening shachrit. So I have my talit and tefillin on. The first guest of the day comes in, and that's the hospice care nurse. I finished the Amidah, turned around to her, said, listen, I'm a Seattle Police and United States Air Force trained chaplain. I do not need your help. Sign the papers and get out of my house, and please don't come back. That's very rare for a Chabad rabbi to say that to somebody, just to point out. She was actually a real mensch, and she said, no problem. She walked out. She walked out, and I'm just about took off my tefillin. My talis was still on. When another guy walks in, he's got wild hair going on, and I'm in this sarcastic mood, and I said, oh, it's Doc Brown from Back to the Future. And he goes, no, I'm the photographer from And Now I Lay Me Down to Sleep. I'm like, oh, okay. I said, little thought goes through my head. I said, do you happen to be Jewish? He goes, well, yes, I am. I said, would you like to put on tefillin? He says, if you'd allow a secular Jew to do so. I said, it would be the greatest of pleasure. And the photographer from And Now I Lay Me Down to Sleep put on tefillin. And I kid you not when I say that the whole house filled with warmth and light that had been, I don't even want to say was lacking, but because there was a brand new energy there. It was really this beautiful, beautiful thing. His picture, one of his pictures, what was that? Sorry. This is the picture that he took. One of the pictures that he took, these black and white pictures. One of the other pictures is actually on the cover of our book. We sent him an email. I thought I didn't have his email address, so unfortunately I wasn't able to ask him permission to put the picture on the cover. But I found his email right maybe 2 months ago and sent him an email and apologized for not getting his permission to put the picture on the book, and sent him a picture of my son, and you'll see a picture of him soon. You'll see what he looks like. And his response was really, really incredible. He said that he had actually lost a child, and that's the reason why he joined this organization. And he said that out of all of his years doing this service, ours was the only, one of the very few that was a photography session in our home, and the only one that had the outcome that we had. So that was quite, quite remarkable to be able to have that. I sent him the book. I don't expect a response, and I apologize. I sent him an apology letter in the book, basically saying, I'm sorry for referring to your organization as macabre. You know, felt really bad because, you know, I described it that way, but I hope that he forgives me in any case. So that was really remarkable, but at the same time, we're still stuck in the same situation. You know, you're holding this baby. We don't know how long he's going to live. Is it an hour? Is it 10 minutes? We just simply don't know. And that night, when right before going to sleep, I said one of the dumbest things I've ever said to my wife, and I've said many dumb things to my wife, she can tell you. And I said, well, if the baby's still alive tomorrow morning, let's start calling doctors in, you know, other cities like Stanford or Philadelphia. And why had I not been making phone calls until then? And the answer is because we'd been indoctrinated, pardon the pun, but really, really, you hear it so much that you think, and even though we're trying to tell ourselves, doctors have permission to heal but not to predict, but we had heard it again and again and again to the point where we didn't realize that there were other avenues. And this is the importance of patient advocacy, because the person going through crisis doesn't realize that there's a way out. Just walk out the door of the hospital and find a different hospital. And we simply didn't know that. We were too exhausted and too under pressure to recognize that this is what it would take. So in any case, God works in humorous ways, apparently, because that morning, 4 o'clock in the morning, actually, my wife asked me to make a bottle for the baby. I gladly did so, zombie-like, and put the bottle on the nightstand, got back in bed, and I hear a second later from my wife, who you see is a very, very calm person. She's actually one of the calmest people I've ever met, and she doesn't usually react like this, and thank God we have a special relationship, and we have a very respectful relationship. So therefore, the conversation that came up was quite humorous, because she was basically asleep. She said, "You didn't screw the nipple on the bottle." I said, "I'm sorry." She said, "You should be." I said, "Oh, now I'm awake. I, you know, quickly go get a towel and try to clean it up and apologize again. I'm sorry." She said, "You should be. I'm all wet. The baby's all wet." And I'm like, "Okay, try to clean everything up, back up, and get back in bed." And I'm thinking to myself, "Why the heck am I going back to sleep? It's time to start calling other doctors." So I get up, I start making some phone calls, and I spoke to a rabbi who put me in touch with a cardiologist in New York. And he said, "You might know that Washington State is the first state to allow assisted suicide, to legally allow assisted suicide." He said these words, "You've been a victim of the right to die movement." And it was just this incredible, incredible recognition of what was going on. And then he said, "Listen, as a cardiologist, pediatric cardiologist, I'm telling you, if the kid's still alive, there's definitely something that you can do, and you have the responsibility to do it. Ethically, legally, morally, halachically." So now this is like, finally, we have somebody who's speaking our language. So I start making some more phone calls, you know, emailing various cardiology clinics across the country. And then I think to myself, around 7 o'clock, I think to myself, you know, the fact is, we really shouldn't be at home. He's deathly ill, and we should get him into Seattle Children's, at least till we can get him somehow life-flighted to some other place. So I called Seattle Children's. It was very strange, because I called Seattle Children's, and they say, "You know, if this is a life-threatening emergency, call 911. I'm like, "It is, but 911 really isn't the number to call here. This is an emergency, you need to speak to the cardiology clinic. And I'm like, I guess it's an emergency, so I'm click. And I speak to one of the nurses, explain the situation. I said, "Can you please have Dr. Vernon, who had diagnosed us, call us back?" She called back at 9 o'clock on the button. She obviously got into the clinic, got this message, and she immediately called us. And she sounded very confused. And I said, "Listen, I know that, you know, Seattle Children's didn't want to take his case because it was too complex." She said, "We were told that you refused invasive care? I said, absolutely not. I told you in our first meeting that we'll do whatever we can for this kid. We were told that Seattle Children's refused his case. She said, Seattle Children's would never turn out a child. How quickly can you get here? I said, 5 minutes. She said, make that 45 because he's going to surgery tonight and you guys need to get, you know, pack up for the weekend. And it was just this unbelievable joy. And at that point, Chairocha was just walking down the steps. I turned to her, I said, the baby's going to surgery. Quick, go pack up. She's like, what? I said, I'll explain to you in the car. And so my in-laws were taking care of getting the kids off to people's houses. We drove off to the hospital. And that was surgery number one. So it was really, really an incredible, incredible experience where everything really, really turned around. That was the beginning of the story. Chairocha.
So finally we had a team that would try. First they did the scans of his stomach, which should have been done initially, and they saw that, yes, he can swallow, and the GI stuff might be some issues down the road, but it's not pressing for now. And then they brought him into surgery. We actually pushed off surgery till Saturday morning because I said, if he's stable, let's wait till you guys are fresh. And they began the stage of repairing his heart. So when a heart is so defective like this, they can't grow the missing ventricle, as you see. I can't tell if it's the right or left. The left side is the little teeny piece.
The right side.
The right side? Okay, yeah. I can't. Oh, yeah. But what they do is they basically replumb.
No, you were right, sorry.
Whatever. They replumb the heart. So basically, instead of the heart having to pump to the lungs and then getting oxygenated blood to the heart and then pumping to the body, they bypass that whole system, literally replumb it, and the blood flow goes directly to the lungs, gets fresh oxygen, and then from the lungs goes to the heart and then goes to the body. So this is a three-stage surgery that they do. They have to wait for certain pressures to be low enough. The baby has to be a certain age, certain size. But with a newborn baby, they do like a stopgap where they put in a BT shunt, which shuttles the blood between the heart and lungs. And then the baby's oxygen levels are like between 70 and 80 until the baby's old enough to be able to begin this more permanent stage of repair. They also had to fix he had veins that were going in the wrong place, so they did various repairs that are very notorious for being tricky. I mean, they had to move veins that were supposed to go between his heart and lungs, and they were going from his heart down to near his liver. And if you think about a heart, it's the size of your fist. So a newborn's heart is the size of, I don't know, like a little, like a walnut with a shell or something. And then the veins that they're moving are like, you know, teeny, teeny. And so they had to move them from one place and sew them into the back of the heart. But, you know, we had been so low that I feel like we came to the hospital in such a different place than most parents come, because we were coming from a place of there was no hope and we had seen the end. Like we were like, you know, we had nothing, someone's giving us hope. It's like we have nothing to lose, and we really felt like I said before, like all these mitzvahs that were done for him, all this, the mission, his life mission, like maybe now we're seeing that we did our best, and like there's purpose, and Hashem is going to keep giving him life because, you know, I don't know, maybe we're just lucky, but we had come from such a low place that we weren't scared coming to surgery. We were just hopeful. We knew that it was going to be good. But the first surgery went well. He had a very rocky recovery. They had to open up his chest again. I won't go into all the gory details of everything that happened. But he started recovering, and we started developing a new normal where we had a baby in the cardiac ICU. We had five other kids. We'd bring them to school. We'd go spend time at the hospital. We'd pick them up from school. We'd go visit the baby. We'd go home and give them dinner, and like that was our life. But at a month, when he was a little shy of a month old, that BT shunt, we got a phone call at 3 o'clock in the morning that they're doing CPR on your son, and that BT shunt had clotted. And they had to do 50 minutes, 5-0, of CPR, and they got him onto ECMO, which is a heart-lung machine, basically, and they sent him off to another surgery to basically open up that shunt that they thought clotted, which is what happened. That was definitely a very, very scary time, but, you know, at that point, our little Nissi, as we called him. We chose to go by the Ashkenazic pronunciation of Nisanel because then we can call him Nissi, which means my miracle. And we chose that nickname when we were in hospice care, hoping that God would maybe give us a miracle. And he clearly did give us a miracle. He really, you know, he rallied. He was strong, and the doctors believed in him. I think they felt like, this kid has been through everything. How can we not stand behind him and try? And they really, really tried, and he pulled through many ups and downs. His appendix ruptured and all this stuff, but he pulled through, and eventually we were able to, he had multiple surgeries, he had 4 open heart surgeries, and we were able to bring him home, and he's, and that's it. He's, you know, he's, thankfully he's a part of our family. Ellie will wrap up a little bit.
The picture. The cardiac arrest was remarkable, because the BT shunt is a silent killer. And the ability to be able to catch that at 3 o'clock in the morning, and not only to catch that, but actually the room, there was a respiratory therapist in the room next door. And a respiratory therapist is the most important person when it comes to breathing. So there were all these different pieces that lined up just incredibly. And my wife mentioned the appendix rupturing. That was also kind of like a last-ditch situation where we thought that this might be it, because when they found free air in his abdomen, the immediate assumption was that his stomach ruptured. And the gut, if the gut ruptures, then obviously we've got major, major problems. They were going to give him an ostomy for bags for his waist. We're like, okay, this kid just got over a cardiac arrest. He just got off of ECMO. Now you're going to put him on an ostomy. You know, that's, I mean, everything was really up in the air. And then the surgeon came back, and the only way to describe him was basically, if you think back to your days watching Looney Tunes, you know, when somebody, one of these guys, heads spinning in two directions at once, that's basically what the surgeon looked like. And he's like, it was his appendix. You know, that the only rupture in his entire gut was at the tip of the appendix, was something that they just recognized was completely, completely beyond just certainly not normal at all. And it was really remarkable, and they were able to bring him through that. So at the same time, going through all of this and going through all of these experiences, there's a very important thought that I'd like to reflect on. And that's in this really remarkable statement from the sages, that every person is required to say of themselves that the world was created for me. Actually, about 17 years ago, I did some work with the JLI, and I translated this. And this is how I didn't know this until I did this work for the JLI. And this idea was so beautiful, and it stuck with me. What does it mean that the world was created for me? And the previous Rebbe has a beautiful, beautiful letter where he describes, he says the word olam actually has 4 different meanings. Here you see them: a physical world, space, concealment, that the definition of a world is the concealment of godliness, which creates otherness and other things. Strength, elem, means a youth, so he's strength. And likewise, time. Olam can mean 50 years, it can mean forever, but time. And he says a person is required to look at themselves and their world and the concealment of godliness in their world, and to say that I have the strength to be able to deal with this in this time and place. And that idea really, really stuck with me. It was one of those concepts, one of those mindsets that really, really, really helped me throughout the entire experience. This year, I don't remember which one's this. This is the operation number 2. So this one is the Glenn. So this is the second of his 2 operations. This is all of us right before his 3rd birthday. So this is before his 2nd, before the 3rd stage operation, the Fontan. The kid next to me on my right is the ex-26-weeker. He was a pound 15 ounces when he was born. Rumor has it that he's 2 inches taller than me, but I do not admit to that in public. And this is the 3rd operation, the Fontan, which is his current cardiac lineup or plumbing, whatever you want to refer to it as. So now today, what does he look like today? He does have cerebral palsy as a result of the cardiac arrest. But he is verbal, he is incredibly intelligent, he's a little bit of a brat, but he's very, very funny. And the one thing that really defines him is quite remarkable, and that's his joy. He is very funny, and he basically just wipes away pain. So he has a G-tube because he stopped eating after one of his previous heart surgeries. Why he did, we don't know. And basically, eating is overrated anyway. So it's really last, you know, we're expecting him to go to his chuppah holding his G-tube bag, you know, something like that. And soon after that G-tube was put in, I picked him up and the tube got hooked onto a chair and pulled at his stomach. And I think we could all imagine that's really painful. And he started crying. He usually doesn't cry. And so Chaya held him close, and he's 2.5, and he's crying for about 10, 12 seconds, and then he picks his head up, tears still on his face, and he says, "Happy now." And that's his character. It's this unbelievable capability not to be focused on the pain of the moment or the situation or the fact that he can't walk or anything like that, but to just be loving it all. And that breaks all barriers in such a way. He just went to camp. This picture is just from a couple weeks ago. And when we sent him to camp, we were really worried about it. You know, what are the other kids going to say in, you know, when they see a kid who speaks a little bit differently or is, you know, is sitting in a wheelchair when he walks. He loves trying to walk, but basically he has to be held by his nurse. He's got a nurse behind him. But that pure joy that you see there just pulled the entire camp into him. And what you see is a face that's always like that and is remarkable to the point that sometimes he wakes up at 3 o'clock in the morning, he throws up all over himself because of his funky GI system, and we'll go in there and change him, and he'll turn over and say, "Sorry about that, Mom. Thank you." And you're like, you're 5 years old. How do you know to do this kind of thing? It's really remarkable. But that joy really, really breaks all boundaries. And that joy is also that which pushes him to try to walk and to do stuff more. He's considered a quadriplegic. So he's limited in all four limbs. And that's why they call him quadriplegic. But he pushes himself beyond what all the therapists have ever thought possible. Our first therapy team, I don't think they thought he would get anywhere. And we had to leave them because they weren't taking him seriously. But he really, really, really has pushed himself. And God willing, I absolutely believe without a question, he will walk someday. And that's the kid that you see. There he is in his gait trainer, which is a mechanism that basically mimics the motion of walking. He's graduated from that to an actual walker. And he can do it for probably several minutes at a time. He can't do it continuously, where he leans on the front and he has to hold himself up and propels himself and harasses his brother on the other side of the room. You know, especially if his Legos are on the floor. Oh God, you can't even imagine. But this is this joy that truly, truly breaks all barriers, both in terms of his own internal barriers as well as others. So that's the story of our medicines, miracles, and mindsets. And we'd be delighted to take any questions. Thank you.
Interested to know about the siblings and how, you know, how they dealt with this. Obviously, the two of you were very.
So there was, you know, the then and the now. Right. So when I was pregnant, we really tried to keep it at a minimum. You know, we told them a little bit because we were so stressed. So we felt like we had to have them recognize why we're stressed. They were pretty young then. Our oldest was 11. So, you know, not that young. When he was in the hospital, we explained everything that was going on in a very basic way, except when he was super, super sick. Like when he was on ECMO and like we didn't know if we could make it. They stayed out of the hospital that week, but for the most part, they were apart. They came when they wanted, they left when they wanted. But we made it like as normal as we could. Now, interestingly enough, our life is so much more about the physical limitations that he has than the medical stuff, even though the medical stuff is there and it kind of gives us sneaky reminders every once in a while.
Like this morning?
Yeah. This morning he woke up sick and I was like, oh no, I don't know if I can come, but he's okay. You know, but by and large, we don't see his heart. His heart is repaired. He's somewhat stable. It's more the he can't walk. He can't sit up. We can't do family things that as easily. And he takes so much of our time and attention. So is your question about now or then or where's your question?
My question is now.
Now, so it's always a juggling act. I feel like my older kids, so our oldest is 16, I feel like my two older kids understand and they appreciate who he is, and they go to bed after him. So like they get their time, you know? But I think my younger kids, it's always a juggling act. We try to make sure that we recognize that he takes a lot of time, but we also try to give them some attention. You know, we try to explain things as much as we can, but we also try to normalize it. So like he sits at the dinner table with us and we have a pool, so we go swimming together. So we try to do things that, you know, our whole family, but it's definitely, we wrote a book about then, not now, because we haven't completely figured out how to live with a child with a disability and make it functional as much as we want. You know, it's still a work in progress. We just recently, you know, 4 months ago or so, got a nurse for 8 hours a day, which has been a game changer, because he needs someone all the time. And so then we can take a kid out by themselves without having to worry who's going to take care of Nissy, you know. So, but for the most part, he's really like, he's one of their siblings, and because he talks and he's cognitive, I think that really helps, because we can have a conversation, he can be part of the family, but he's fun and he's funny, so I think that helps also. But, you know, it's a juggling act. I don't really have like a, this is what we do and we have the answer to everything. If you have any other specific questions or advice.
Did you file any complaints against the hospital? It makes me furious.
Yes, yes. There are several dozen people who would probably kill Dr. Ralph if they met him. We did put in a complaint, and the hospital immediately sent us an email back saying, or a letter back, a form letter, saying that he did nothing against NICU protocol. And we said, that's absolutely insane, because you sent us home without a car seat. We're pretty sure that's against state protocol, federal protocol, forget about NICU protocol. So we said we want another investigation. They did a second investigation, which was much more thorough and revealed much more of the liabilities that he had in the entire case. But they concluded the same conclusion. And they said we were sorry for the breakdown in communication. And that just absolutely infuriated me, because I said we were brutally clear with what we wanted throughout the entire process. And we had witnesses, you know, because we'd been sharing this story with people. There were people who were in the conversations. These were not, you know, private. This was not really just a private matter. So we went from there to the Washington State Medical Board. However, the Washington State has its largest employer happens to be the University of Washington. So who do you think runs the Washington State Medical Board? That's not official, but it was quite obvious from the fact that after a year and a half investigation, I got a response that mistakes were made, but they dealt with it in-house. I said, what did they deal with? They said, we can't tell you that because that's private. So I basically sent an email to the deans of the medical school and CC'd the president of the entire university and said, if you don't get back to me within, I don't remember what it was, 12 hours or 24 hours, I'm going to the media with this. Well, I got an email almost immediately from the president of the school saying, I don't know what happened, but we're going to find some answers for you. Then I got a phone call back from the deans, and I had had a meeting with the deans as well about this, and they'd said that they'd look into it, whatever it is, but it didn't go anywhere. And I said, listen, there are protocols that I want you guys to change. And they said, okay, give us a list of them and we'll work on them. They told me that they changed them, but at that point we had already moved to Miami and I didn't have the energy to actually kind of really, really put the hammer down on, figure out what they had changed and what they hadn't. And it's in general dealing with a child with a disease, everything in life is about allocating your energy. And just there was, at that point, this was already 4 years out, and at that point I was like, okay, they said they're sorry, they said that they're going to make changes. They made certain changes that were, that they told us at least, that, for example, he had, what one of the investigations had revealed was that he took control of the case. So the reasons why we didn't see a cardiologist was because he made the case into his own little fiefdom, and the regular processes weren't being followed. And so that was completely, that should never have been allowed in the first place. We didn't ask him to control the case, we asked him to be an advocate. That's very different. So that was made absolutely not, that's not allowed whatsoever. But the second thing, which was bigger, which was an important change, was that in any case where there's a critical care needed at birth, they agreed to have that discipline at the birth instead of a person who would be called. Which again, why the heck was this not part of protocol as well? But it's as a result of disasters that you see the flaws in your system, and this, of course, there we go, financially. Okay, that's
also
a good point.
Also now, a lot of hospitals, can you hear me?
Yeah, you're good.
A lot of hospitals now, children's hospitals, have a labor and delivery ward on site, so babies are not transported anymore. So that eliminates a lot of the problem also.
Right, so we were told...
I think that they're doing that now at Seattle Children's.
Yeah, we were told that they had that in the plans, but because of our case, they actually pushed it into the fast lane because this was such a disaster of a situation. They're like, okay, so there's a room in Seattle Children's which spiritually has our name on it. But we spoke to lawyers about medical malpractice, and we're told that malpractice has three elements of it. You have to prove liability, that we could prove. But then you have to prove standard of care wasn't met. And in our case, because the fact is that even if the hospital had done everything right, from a medical perspective, he really should not have survived those 4 days. And so, and even he shouldn't have survived birth and that kind of thing, because he didn't have a functional system. The only reason why he survived was because of the PDA, the part and the ductus arteriosus that stayed open. But his surgeon later told us, he said, even with the ductus arteriosus, it still doesn't make sense because that ductus is so small, it's not enough to give him the amount of blood flow that he would need to be able to function, for his entire body to function. He was having oxygen saturation rates in those first few days anywhere from the 60s up to the 80s. And the surgeon said there's no way that he should have had that level of oxygen saturation with just the ductus arteriosus. So... standard of care, well, he's not going to live. And then the final thing, of course, is the question of damages. Well, your kid's functioning, so basically you have no damages. So therefore, there was nowhere to sue. So we wrote the book and said, no.
And our book is for sale outside. So anyone who's...
please buy a copy, one for yourself, one for your friend.
One for your doctors.
No, but...
thank you.
I just wanted to share a little bit about our writing the book, just so, you know, we'd spoken a lot. People said they wanted to hear the story. Obviously, we can't tell the whole story on one foot. But we also really wanted to share some of the mindsets that really got us through, which we touched on. But, and in addition to that, we also wanted to share a second part of the book, which... as our experience, you know, some of the lessons we learned. So there's a second section that has, you know, advice or mindsets for medical professionals, some of the Jewish ideas of a doctor's permission to heal but not to predict, and those sort of concepts. And then we wrote a section to families going through crisis, what sort of things helped us, both spiritual mindsets and practical stuff, like, you know, you have to sit down and figure out what's important and drop the other things that are not important when you're in crisis mode and things like that. And then also a third section for friends who have someone going through a crisis and they want to help, but they're not sure how. So some of the, you know, not that we know everything, but these are some things that we learned going through our journey and friends shared with us. So that's sort of a nutshell what the book is the story, and then sort of some practical takeaways.
Please visit myjli.com to learn more about JLI's multiple educational offerings, and toracafe.com to view highlights and lectures from past retreats.